You're listening to Co-op Mood, a casually serious conversation about playing video games.
This is episode 8, Tabletop Role-Playing Video Games.
It's all happening. I'm Sally. You can find me on Twitter at SallyT.
And I'm Shane. You can find me on Twitter at Mundangerous.
All right, so Shane, we start every episode with a story from the world of video games that has captivated us for one reason or another. So we're going to talk about the Nintendo Giga Leak, which...
Who names these?
I honestly would like another stab at naming this Giga Leak because I agree. I don't like the sound of it. I don't like the portmanteauing that went into it.
Bad mouthfeel. It's all bad. Two bad flavors that taste bad together.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. So basically what happened was someone, it seems to be unknown who, what person or persons did this, but got an unprecedented amount of information by some sort of hack from Nintendo. So tons and tons of files that were posted to 4chan, of course, if you're gonna do a big old hack.
Right. A video game stuff. You're
going to want to go ahead and put it on 4chan. So this hack revealed just an absolute ton of information, including Wii source code, detailed schematics for Nintendo hardware, various game concepts and character design concepts that were, you know, scrapped or never made it, to fruition. But just like a huge amount of information that gives a ton of detail about kind of the history of a bunch of different like Nintendo properties, as well as you can sort of just like piece together Nintendo, I would say, like game design philosophy from looking at the stuff that was leaked. So Shane, like what are your opening thoughts on ye old Giga Leak?
So I played Nintendo, I had an NES. I did not have a Super Nintendo or an N64 or a Wii or any other Nintendo game. So I guess like Nintendo has that place in history, and that's important. And like some of the stuff that's been found out here is like around like Super Mario 64 or like, you know, a canceled Pokemon MMO or like early renderings of Yoshi and Bowser, right? Which is like cool from a historical perspective to me, but like doesn't change my relationship to those games because they were like, they're still just games that like I played at a friend's house or, you know, like I never understood quite the pedestal that Nintendo is on some of that stuff. So, it's interesting. Like it's cool. Like Yoshi was a horse. Sweet.
Yoshi was a horse definitely should have been the title of this episode, by the way, but that's okay.
Yeah, but like there's stuff like, you know, people are acting like it's some bombshell that Luigi was rendered in Super Mario World 64 or who cares that much about the plumber's brother, like
the plumber's brother. Oh my god, that's such a harsh roast of Luigi. But yeah, I mean, yeah, I had an NES. My brother got an NES, and it was like a formative. We had an Atari 7800, but really, I would say the NES was like when I fell in love with video games and console gaming and stuff like that. But I also didn't play. I mean, the Switch is the next Nintendo console I owned after that. So I did play some Super Nintendo, like at friends' houses and stuff. I don't think I ever played an N64 or GameCube or any. Oh, I think I might have had a. No, I don't think I had a Game Boy, but I think like friends had Game Boys and I played those. So I guess what I'm saying is I just don't care about Nintendo in the way that I think you would have to care about Nintendo to get really worked up about the leak. I think, you know, we were talking before we started recording about like why some of this is like a bummer in terms of like interesting archival material becoming a security issue versus like just being information that could one day be out in the world in an interesting way. And I guess Nintendo has a reputation for being like particularly secretive in an industry that's already like basically built on secrecy. So yeah, I mean, I guess in some ways this is like a little bit of a, you know, a fuck you to Nintendo because I feel like the you know, if you're a hacker, you really want to, the like company you want to stick it to most is the company that's like extra secretive with their material. But like, I guess, yeah, my overall takeaway is that like, I also don't really care that much because I don't feel that connected to Nintendo and I don't feel that connected to video game history. I think it's interesting, but I'm not like a video game archivist who's like lives and dies by like how this information comes out.
Right.
I will say that like, it probably would be a very cool coffee table book of like, you know, the untold history of Nintendo from whatever year to whatever year, which maybe they were saving for
right.
for that.
Maybe they're saving it until they're like, they're on plan Z and making the Nintendo Hotel.
Yeah, exactly. Oh man, the Nintendo can't wait to stay in that place. But yeah, I mean, the stuff about like the Pokemon MMO and what was the game like Super Donkey or something?
Yeah, I think that was Yoshi World or Yoshi's Island, I think, is Super Donkey.
Yeah. Yeah, which is, it's fun. I mean, and there was a tweet from one of the Star Fox developers who was like, oh my God, I haven't seen this source code in like 30 years. Like, this is how I created Star Fox 2. And that's all very, very cool. But I think, you know, we don't have to grapple with the implications of this because we're not like historians or archivists.
Yeah. I mean, so there's also that angle too, right? Which I think is important. Like, it is theft. It is their intellectual property that's now being laid out for the world. It was theirs to do with as they wish. And also, Nintendo is one of the few video game companies that, like, apparently keeps a very, very long-running and detailed archive, which is great because a lot of companies don't because, like, it's expensive and also, like, they don't last that long. So, like, there's a lot of important video game history in this archive, right? Like, foundational history of how we interact with video games. Like, this is the early part of it. And now that is just laid bare, and that puts, or could put, like, a freezing effect on our, you know, companies willing to even deal with saving this stuff. Is it not safer to just delete your source code, right? Or delete your renderings or whatever it is, right? Only keep what you need to do the remaster. You know, so like that stuff is bad. Like, I don't think there's an argument that leaking this is good for anybody except people who want a cool peek into history.
Totally.
You know, you wish that Nintendo would kind of let this out in a way that's like, hey, here's a cool thing that we still have. You know, like, check out this like early rendering of like the Mario Kart dev kit. You know, like, great. Like, I'd love to see that. I'd watch that YouTube video. You know, I wish they had been doing something with it, but yeah, I don't know. Like, I'm not super excited. I don't think this like greatly changes the world, or changes my relationship to any of these games. Pokemon MMO, when?
I think that, you know, it is important to remember that this is theft. It's not just like some thing, even though like the victim is a corporation. You know, leaks are really cool when it's a whistleblower thing, and like something that is needs to be exposed is exposed. It's less cool when it's like for no reason at all, and it could, you know, it could impact like just like what our access to this kind of information could look like in the future, and you know what archivists have to deal with now and stuff. So that is important to remember. Ultimately, this is a thing that a lot of people were talking about, and now we're talking about it.
Yeah.
But that I also just that I don't feel like a huge amount of connection to, even though it is fun to like, you know, click on an article about the Giga Leak and scroll through and see what like Yoshi was actually going to look like. That's fun.
Four legs, kind of like a llama.
Yeah. Yeah, kind of like surprisingly llama-esque, I think we can say.
Everyone's calling him a horse, but he's a llama.
No, he's a llama. I think we're breaking news on this podcast that he was definitely a llama. Okay, actually, before we talk about what we're playing right now, we're going to just mention a game that we are no longer playing right now, but we did record a bonus episode about for One Shot Network Patreon members. If you want to hear Shane and me talk at extreme length about The Last of Us 2, you should become a member.
You should, yeah. If you support One Shot on Patreon at the secret archive level, you can find our episode. If you're already a patron, you can go check it out right now. It is available in the patron feed, and you probably got an email.
I just want to say $5 for all the bonus content from all the podcasts on One Shot is the deal of a century.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a One Shot patron at $5. So I listen to the Secret Archive. Go check out the Bin Bon and Jubna episodes from Star Wars Campaign. Those are some of my favorite and most joyful podcasts. There's also System Mastery Positive, which is from the guys of the System Mastery podcast, talking about things they actually like instead of bad old role-playing games. And then, of course, you can listen to us talking about The Last of Us 2 in exhaustive detail. Spoiler-filled detail.
Yeah. If you haven't played it and you want to not be spoiled, do not listen. But if you have played it or you want to have it spoiled from every possible direction, this episode is for you.
Okay. Out of the cut-in, back to the show.
Let's talk about what we are playing right now. Shane, what video games have you been playing since we last recorded?
Only one. I started playing League of Legends.
Yeah, you did.
Like, I know that I'm 11 years late to the game, but I am starting to play it, and there goes my life. So, rip all other games.
Nice. I love that. But it's still being, like, you know, developed and stuff, right? Like, they're still releasing stuff for it?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Cool.
Oh, yeah. There's, 160 characters, like, lots of meta, lots of complicated, like, interactions to learn, builds, items, gameplay. Yeah, it's a lot. I mean, it's an esport game, right? And it is every bit that complicated. So it's been fun to learn anew everything.
I love this for you. This sounds like it has the kind of depth that you're going to be able to get really into in terms of, like, optimization and stuff like that.
Yeah, and then in like 3 weeks, it'll all be for nothing because I'll be like, I suck at this game. I'm not good. I hate it. I quit. I'm hard stuck gold.
Well, it's gonna be a glorious 3 weeks.
We'll see.
Do you have a character that you like to play? Is it one of those things where, like, someone's a tank, someone's a healer?
Yeah, so the way that League works, it's a MOBA. So you have, like, creeps that spawn on a timer, and that's sort of the, like, main focus of the game for the early part. It's broken into three lanes, top, middle, and bottom. And so, like, you kill those creeps in order to gain experience and gold while you are trying to avoid getting killed by enemy champions and or kill enemy champions, right? So ultimately, it's a game about outperforming your opponent in your lane and then grouping up as a team to fight. And then, you know, ultimately, like, capturing the map objectives by doing that. So it is every lane has a different sort of play style and role to it. So I've played a couple different lanes, but the character that I play most now is Garen, who is a top lane, which is what everyone says is the boring lane because it's the furthest away and has to play on its own, which I love.
Nice.
So, like, I don't have to pay attention to my team. I just have to win my lane, and then if they don't screw up enough, then I am fed and I am, like, you know, two levels higher than everybody else with a bunch of gold and a bunch of items, and I can run through and just stomp teams. So that's kind of the play style.
Ideal.
Yeah.
Nice.
And then I've also played a little mid and a little bit of ADC, which is, like, bottom lane. So I've played all three lanes, but I think top lane is going to be where I spend my time because I'm a weirdo, I guess. Nobody likes top.
That sounds awesome. I'm really into it, and I look forward to hearing more about it. Does your team have a name? Is that a thing that you do in this game?
No, absolutely not. No. So, we picked it up. Five of us picked it up in our, like, D&D group. So one person has played before. One person has played a very, very, very long time ago and not very much. And three of us have never played. So I, like, literally went from actively avoiding League information to I'm a League player.
You're deep in it. I love that. So you guys kind of have, like, a Bad News Bears vibe right now.
We are very Bad News Bears. Yeah, five people roll in, five people lose.
Love that. Man, okay. Well, I'm excited about this journey for you.
What about you?
Okay, so I am playing this game from 2016 called The Witness. Mm-hmm. Do you know this game, Shane?
I remember it, or I remember the title, but I don't remember anything about it. So,
okay, so it's a puzzle game. It actually reminds me a lot of Myst. You're on an island, and you sort of come to, and it's in the first person, and you walk around. I think it's an island, and you solve various puzzles. I believe that the game also has a story, because at one point we picked up an audio log, but we haven't. So my partner and I are playing together. Oh. We like sit on the couch and I control us, and we together try to figure out how to solve the puzzles.
Couch
co-op, exactly. So every puzzle is like a panel, and you have to, so far there's over 500 puzzles, which I think if I had known that before I started, I would not have started the game. we've done like 60 of them.
Oh my God.
What it is like, yeah, you walk up to a panel and you have to sort of figure out what the logic of the puzzle is and what the various like symbols in the puzzle mean, and then you can solve them. I would say it's pretty challenging. We definitely got to a point after like around 60 where my wife was like, I fucking hate this game. We're never playing it again. I think that might wear off and we will play it again, because it's actually been challenging in a good way and very satisfying to figure out the puzzles. And it's very beautiful. Like, it's really nice looking. Mm-hmm. But 500 is just like a lot. I don't know. Again, this is like, I go back to this all the time, but like, video games should all come in like regular, large, and like supersized, where like instead of, so with like Assassin's Creed Odyssey, instead of being like, I'm just like only going to do the main missions and not do the side quests, or I'm going to do I can't even remember all the different like exploration things you can do in that game. What developers should do, because it's not hard enough to develop a really amazing AAA video game, is they should create a version of every game where you get the full experience of the game, but in like smaller chunks. Because the thing is, if you want to make like a 150-hour game, a 60-hour game, you just play less of the game, but you might not get a full storyline. You might miss out on certain quests and stuff like that. So that is what if I was the king of video games, I would require all games to release a regular, large, and supersized mode, because The Witness is like, it just comes in supersized, and I would really like to play it in regular size.
Can motion on the table to name this day job mode, as in I have a day job. I would like this game to be satisfying for me too, please.
Exactly. Adult with a day job who like also would like to come back to the game after taking a break and remember like
anything.
Something about how to proceed in it. Yeah.
Literally anything I was doing, please.
Literally anything. So the other thing I'm playing is Borderlands 3, which I've never played any Borderlands games before, okay. But my brother and I really like to play shooters together. Mm-hmm. We Far Cry is one of our favorite things to play. And I kind of hit a wall with Far Cry where it's just not it right now for like what's going on in the world. Mm-hmm. It was like barely even it when
it was
these
also
things were
yeah,
going on
it was
in the
borderline
world.
It.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So I saw that Borderlands 3 was on sale at GameStop for $20. And so I insisted that we each buy it. We did. Played it for the first time. It's really fun. The art style is really cool. It has a goofy sense of humor that sometimes is really annoying and makes me roll my eyes. Other mm-hmm. times is really fun. I really like that I can customize my character's outfit. So he's all like in like vaporwave colors, which I'm excited about.
That's day job mode right there.
That's like day job mode. Exactly.
Full aesthetic customization.
Yeah. In fact, like take away like 50% of the gameplay and just let me customize a character. That's all that's fine.
Easier aesthetics than I'm in.
Exactly. It's pretty fun. It required me to, in order to play co-op, I had canceled my Xbox Live and like Xbox Game Pass. I don't even honestly know which one it was that was enabling me to play co-op, but I had canceled it because when I had Game Pass, I was basically obsessively downloading and playing games and not sticking with any of them because, mm-hmm. it, you know, it was like some nominal amount of money a month to have access to like everything.
Yep.
I now have Game Pass like Ultimate or something. So I'm going to be back on my Game Pass bullshit, because now also like a bunch of new stuff has been released on Game Pass that I'm excited about. So, you know, get ready for me to talk about a new game every single week that I'll play an hour of.
That's great. We need that for content, because all I get to talk about for the next X years of my life is League.
Right. That's actually true. Okay. So I can sort of pick up the slack when this becomes a League podcast. Yeah. I can like pipe in about how I played half an hour of something.
Right. All I'll do every fortnight is, nope, can't say that in this industry.
Nope.
Like every 2 weeks I'll report on how I've risen or fallen in ELO. Like that's my
love
League
it.
Update.
I love it. Cool. I mean, we might just do like a new segment that's like Shane's League update.
Okay. That's terrible.
So, having said all that, I'm very excited for our main segment today, which I would like to say is also like the way that we put this segment together, I think is a really interesting peek behind the curtain of how this podcast gets made, which often is that I'm like, oh my God, let's do this idea. And you're like, okay, cool. But like, how exactly would that work? And like, what, like, can we drill into how we would talk about it for 20 minutes and have it be interesting? And I'm like, shit, that's a really good call. So without further ado, Shane, let me say what this segment is about, which is we are going to talk about tabletop role-playing games that we would like to see adapted into video games and exactly how that adaptation would work. Is that a good summary, Shane?
Yeah, I mean, this is a tale as old as time, right? Like, as long as there have been video games, there's been video game adaptations of Dungeons and Dragons, and therefore, like, or board games, frankly. Like, that's what a lot of early video games are, adaptations of board games. So yeah, I mean, I think this is finally somebody asked us, we asked ourselves, what would we like to see from tabletop games in our video games?
Exactly. We asked us, and you came up with a couple of like really good questions to guide us in like kind of a rubric to like actually do this, which is again, like something that I wasn't thinking of and probably wouldn't have. I was just ready to like run up to a microphone and start like yelling into it. But like one of the things that you made as a rule is that like the video game that we come up with shouldn't be an RPG, because that's just sort of like, you know, Knights Black Agents, but make it a video game role-playing game.
Yeah. Like you could always do that. That's the genre.
That's right. Exactly. That's the genre. So like that is a thing. That is one of our rules. I guess it's kind of, well, it's the only like hard and fast rule, but then we have some like guiding questions, which another thing you brought up is like what are the rules for like when a video game does a good job of representing the RPG. Is that a good way of putting it?
Yeah, I think that's right.
So we came up with like some things that the adaptation would need to accomplish. And I'll just like, I'll say a couple of them and then like, Shane, feel free to like pipe in if you have any other ones. So one thing that was big for me is that like the video game has to capture the ambiance and like the feeling of the role-playing game. And I think a lot of times like the feeling of a game has to do with like the group and the DM and, you know, if you're doing like a pre-written like module, mm-hmm. what the feeling is in that. But a lot of games just really like canon wise have a very, very specific feel to them. And the video game, I think, has to have that feel for it to be like a decent adaptation.
Yeah. And then going along with feel, I think you also need to include the lore of the RPG. So, you know, the world building and the background that exists that kind of underpins every tabletop role-playing game, I think, is like, if you leave that behind in the video game, you're missing out, right? I mean, it's a nominal adaptation. It has really nothing to do in like its heart and soul with its source material.
Totally. And the next one is like, I think maybe a combination of the first two, which is that like, if I'm playing a video game adaptation of a role-playing game, I want to feel like I'm acting upon the world of the RPG. Like it's not enough to capture just the atmosphere or the feeling and throw the lore in there. I want to feel like I'm in a well-realized world that the character I'm playing is able to like act in and act upon and change in some way.
Yeah, that's almost like the no MMO rule.
Like, yeah, exactly.
Like you can't just have a static world to interact with that resets every 8 minutes. That's cheating.
Exactly. Yeah. The world has to be like richly imagined and developed and dynamic.
Right. And then the last one is that there has to be an element of player choice that impacts the outcome of the game, or at least convinces you that you're affecting the outcome of the game. No, like point and click story adventure, right? Like you have to actually make choices and be interacting with the world. No, just throwing out a visual novel of your favorite D&D module, Sally.
Yeah, although I would play that, but that's not, but not for this segment.
Right.
Definitely would love to play Curse of Strahd, the visual novel, just to be clear. Okay, so Shane, what is your brilliant idea for a video game that captures a role-playing game?
I don't know if it's brilliant, but the tabletop role-playing game that I would like to see adapted to video games is Phoenix Dawn Command, which is an RPG by Dan Garrison and Keith Baker that was released in 2015. It is the concept of the game is that you are phoenixes who are like supernatural, like divinely inspired protectors of the world. And you are fighting against a threat called the Dread, sort of this encroaching army of darkness, zombie kind of apocalypse that is encroaching upon the world. So it's dark in that sense. It's very like action and combat oriented. And like what makes it cool as an RPG is that your character sheet is your deck of cards. And the cards in your hand are what allow you to like accomplish actions, right? So instead of rolling dice to determine the outcome, you play cards. And you always know like when you set out to do something, whether or not you can succeed because you know the cards in your hand. Over time, right, it's random what cards are in your hand. You might have a low hand and it's difficult, you're gonna fail, or it might have a high hand and you can do whatever you want, but like you know that going in, and then over time it changes, right? So that feeling of like predetermination I think is important. And then also the most important piece of it is you only level up by dying. So what tends to happen is you make a noble sacrifice, you die, you're a phoenix, so you're reborn, and you're reborn at a new level, which means you get to add cards to your deck, remove cards from your deck, right? That's the deck building element. That's your character building choices. So it's a fun like tabletop element, right? And as a group, you're oftentimes like, who is going to step in and save the group from this huge threat, right? Who's going to make the big sacrifice so that we can win? What is that going to cost us? You know, like, so that question I think is an interesting one.
Okay, I love what you've done here because I've never played Phoenix Dawn Command, but I've always wanted to. The thing of like you level up by dying is just cool and intriguing and interesting. So tell me what the video game looks like.
So I looked around for an inspiration of a game that involves a lot of player dying and trying again. And I landed on a Dark Souls style action adventure game.
Okay.
So like, cause the concept of Phoenix, like the framing structure is missions. So you get sent out on a mission to kill a boss, right? Or to stop an event, right? Very Dark Souls style. Mm-hmm. It would be somewhat difficult, of course. You have like customization options, right? That's your deck building element, gear, all that kind of thing. But as you die, you get stronger. So the game gets easier as you die until you hit a certain point where if you die, you lose, game over, right? So you can kind of have that press your luck kind of mechanic. And then I think the challenging part of implementing that in a video game is that you don't have a human being telling you, oh, it's fine that you're level 4 right now and everyone else is level 1. Don't worry, you know, whereas like, if you get too far behind and start snowballing those deaths early on, the game might become trivial in a video game. You know, the challenge disappears, or you might just not be able to make it because you died twice in the first map, like, or the first mission. Like that would kind of suck too. So careful tweaking on that. But I think like that would really capture it. You could do a lot with like cutscene storytelling, maybe mission selection, right? Like choose which mission you deal with and put like little bit of a campaign overlay on it. Because ultimately like you're super heroic champions who get dispatched by like, you know, a mission control kind of group, right? The Phoenixes are organized. So you can have those kind of discrete events in a way that, like, you know, like a Command and Conquer style campaign overlay, like, mm-hmm. do you fight this mission or this mission? You know, you could kind of introduce some of those elements.
I love that. Do you choose like a class in Phoenix Dawn Command?
Yes. So there are several. They all have very like fitting like thematic names, like Devoted mm-hmm. or Durant or Elemental or Shrouded.
Nice.
Or my personal favorite, the character that I played was the Bitter, who is the Raging Barbarian. So the closer you get to death, the more powerful you are, which meant I was always flirting with death.
That's fucking awesome. That has so much cool like roleplay stuff built into it. Do you envision the video game would similarly like have you choose a class?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. Yeah. And then like it just takes you down like specialization trees because all of them have their own kind of specializations within the cards that come for their class. So but yeah, you know, and then add in some gear and give you those kind of overlays. I think it makes sense. You get enough differentiation.
Nice. I love that. I definitely want to play Phoenix Dawn Command of the video game.
All right. So let's talk about your TTRPG VG.
So my TTRPG VG is what I've done really is I've combined two of my greatest loves. One is the game Tales from the Loop with the video game Watch Dogs 2, essentially. So, so Tales from the Loop is a game that was actually it's actually based on the art of Simon Stålenhag, whose name I'm probably mispronouncing, a Swedish illustrator. And the game was originally a stretch goal on a Kickstarter campaign for publication of the art book, which I love that factoid. And when you buy the book, it's like Tales from the Loop is absolutely worth buying the actual hardcover book instead of just like looking at the PDF because the art is so gorgeous. And I've actually also bought Simon Stålenhag's art books. But basically, Tales from the Loop takes place in an alternate version of the 1980s where the game was written to take place in a particular setting in Sweden, but they also... They made like a American equivalent so that people in the US could like set it someplace familiar. And that in the US setting, it's called Boulder City, Nevada. Mm-hmm. And it's a place where during the Cold War era, early Cold War era, there was this project called The Loop, which was a particle accelerator. And in the lore of the game, the project to create this particle accelerator failed, but the loop remains, the loop now defunct, remains a site of just like weird shit that happens. Kind of stuff that's like, not like supernatural weird, but like kind of sci-fi weird. Mm-hmm. Like big, like Stranger Things vibes, like in the ambiance of the game.
Cool.
Yeah. And like the other thing is that like the loop project was also taking place in other parts of the world where it progressed and resulted in these technologies that make the world of Tales from the Loop really interesting. So there are these things called magnetrine ships, which are these gigantic ships that kind of float a mile in the air, and they are held there by like the magnetic pull of the earth. And there's also been developments in like robotics. So it's like not uncommon for there to be like robots in the world. Mm-hmm. So the way Tales from the Loop works is that you play a kid who's between the ages of, I want to say 10 and 15. And there are six principles that like guide the way the game is played. And they are, your hometown is full of strange and fantastic things. Everyday life is dull and unforgiving. Adults are out of reach and out of touch. The land of the loop is dangerous, but the kids will not die. The game is played scene by scene. The world is described collaboratively. And I think that those principles are really important to note because they contribute to the way the game feels to play. So, you know, the game is played scene by scene, and in some scene you just act out with your, you know, with other players or the GM, just scenes from everyday life, like being in a boring math class or your parents making you do chores. And then the other scenes that you act out are like with the other kids, the other PCs, where you're solving some weird, cool mystery. And it's just a really like just super atmospheric game. And if you've ever watched like Stranger Things, like you kind of, it's like, yeah, it's like Goonies, like E.T., like just, it has this like kind of magical feeling to it. So my thought was to take Tales from the Loop and basically reskin Watch Dogs 2, essentially. So Watch Dogs 2 is a game from 2016, I think, by Ubisoft. And in that game, you play a hacker, and it's in kind of a fictionalized version of San Francisco. And the thing that is very cool about Watch Dogs 2 is that the city feels like a really important part of the like the world of the game. So, you know, there's like stores and restaurants and monuments and parks, and it just, it feels really lived in. And a huge part of Tales from the Loop is collaboratively building the city that your game takes place in, which, you know, in the role-playing game you do at the table with the people you play with. But, you know, I'm fine with like hiring some talented writers to like create the world for a video game.
Yep.
You know, and the other thing that I have to say, like hugely influences my love of Watch Dogs 2 is that, and why I want you to play it so badly, is that if you want to, you can spend most of your time playing, as I did, just dressing up your character in like various amazing outfits from all the various like stores in the city. So there's like a store that's kind of like the Gap, that's just like kind of basics. There's like a skating, there's a store that's like skater fashion. There's like a store that's kind of a Brooks Brothers store. So you can just make amazing looks. And a huge part of the appeal for Tales from the Loop is just like the aesthetic of the 1980s for me. Like just, you know, thinking about like the cool ass, like members only jacket your character is wearing, right? And like, you know, and like thinking about like the Walkman they're carrying. So I just like love aesthetically what it would be like to like live in a really cool AAA Ubisoft version of Tales from the Loop. But then, you know, the other thing about Tales from the Loop is that because it's really about being a kid and being in this place and interacting with these different environments, interacting with parents, with teachers, with other kids, with bullies, whatever. Watch Dogs 2, something it does really well is like, you know, in Watch Dogs 2, you play a hacker and you have to deal with like, there's a couple of gangs you have to deal with. There, you have to deal with cops, you have to deal with private security. Just there's a cool thing where you can like hack into other people's phone and just like see what other people's like lives are like. And I think Tales from the Loop would translate really well to that, because you could have like a main mission of like, you know, there's some funky thing happening at the loop that you have to solve. And then there's side quests that, you know, cause you to have to like interact with other parts of the world, like other kids or teachers or, you know, the PTA. Like I just, there's just like endless possibilities for capturing, for capturing the world of Tales from the Loop. You necessarily lose some of the really cool things of Tales from the Loop, which is that like it's like the system is like it's the year zero system. It's like a dice pool basically. Mm-hmm. And it's pretty, I don't know if it's technically like rules light, but it feels kind of rules light, which means that a lot of it is really about the world building and like the collaborative storytelling, which, you know, in a way it's like, why would you ever make a video game out of that? Because you're stripping all of that away. So,
right.
You know, it feels like a bad idea, but if I were going to execute a bad idea really well, I would make Tales from the Loop into Watch Dogs 2.
So I think like that's a good point. And so I think one of the ways that you could kind of make that work in an odd way is like let those world building questions occur early in the game and then shape your open world environment around those questions, right? So that like, you know, as you're asked, like as a character, you're asked to say something about your home, right? And the option that you pick then informs when you go into your home what it looks like, right? So like you're not necessarily making like obviously the huge kind of sweeping changes that you could potentially make in a tabletop game, where you have, you know, the power of imagination, like, but you can kind of render certain things a little differently in a way that makes it feel like you had a choice in that. While the core kind of like primary story, right, still really, really drives forward on its own. But yeah, no, that's really cool. I think the other challenge that you run into in video games a lot of times is like kids have a weird amount of agency, you know, like, and in Tales from the Loop, it's like they're mostly just ignored by the adults, you know? So like, you've got to kind of get over that whole thing. Like if an adult walks, like if you walk into an adult, they're going to be like, what are you doing here, kid? Like you're 10, where are your parents?
Yeah, totally. Yeah, it is like a weird but very cool feature of Tales from the Loop that like if you it's just basically like a rule in the world that if you go to an adult and are like, this thing is really weird, can you please help me? They're like, I don't believe you, everything is fine, which is a way that the game gets around. You know, it's like if in Buffy the Vampire Slayer, if everyone had cell phones, like the show would be like one season long, you know? Exactly. So that's the way Tales from the Loop deals with that. And I think it would be a cool but difficult thing to translate to a game. I just want to say like one thing about your suggestion that I really like is it actually ties in something from the game, which is that in Tales from the Loop, you have a hideout. You and the other PCs choose a place that is safe. It's like physically safe and psychologically safe, and you can go there to like heal conditions that you know that you've taken on that impose a penalty on your like skill checks and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And I think it would be one really cool way of bringing in some of that world building is like having, being able to customize your hideout early in the game.
Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah, I think we've invented two really cool video games that someone should probably kickstart.
Somebody pay us a lot of money so that we can go make them and also license and their properties.
Yeah. Oh yeah. That small detail. The other thing is that like, as I was like thinking of like ideas for this segment, I was thinking like, oh my God, this would take so many years to like develop. It's so difficult and intricate. But then I was thinking about like Disco Elysium, which was like, I think I read that it was like, they were making it for like 10 years. So, you know, anything's possible.
Right. With enough bourbon.
With enough bourbon and like enough either like funding or like letting the rest of your life fall to pieces. Anything is possible.
Yep.
Should we talk about our honorable mentions, Shane?
Yeah, I think these were a little too obvious for this segment, but still ideas that like I liked. I started with Blades in the Dark, which is a game about like the criminal underworld of a fantasy industrial city, in which you are a gang who either, you know, it has some type of specialty. So typically people play it as thieves, but you could be, you know, footpads or whatever as well. But yeah, basically it would be your your kind of dark fantasy open world crime game, right? So your GTA, but in this kind of haunted fantasy industrial city with this really, you know, kind of cool aesthetic. And it would be driven by the, you know, the personal interactions with the members of your crew, and then sort of what the, you know, like the crew would come with you on missions and you would kind of plan out how you're going to approach it and do that sort of thing. I'm thinking kind of like the heist mode of GTA Online, or like I guess GTA 5 had heists in it too, but something sort of like that. That'd be kind of the gameplay loop, but just in a Blades in the Dark world. Man, I love it.
Yeah, open world crime game, like you had me at hello. That sounds fucking amazing.
Look, they did it with the Godfather, okay? Like open world crime game could be anything now.
I totally agree, and it honestly doesn't even have to be that good of a game. I'm still gonna want to play it.
Right. What about yours?
So my honorable mention is Knights Black Agents, which is like a vampire spy thriller game. It's based on the gumshoe system. So the way that Knights Black Agents works and like kind of the theory behind gumshoe is that it's not interesting to play a game where you're like looking for clues. It's more interesting to just get the clues because you're a dope ass spy with like amazing tradecraft, and then like interpret those clues and like figure out exactly what's going on.
Yep.
I thought that would be really cool. Like I've played some mystery games where Like LA Noire is one of them. And there's this game, I think it's called Interrogation, You Will Be Deceived, which is like, give me a break, but a colon in a video game title. I just don't know about it. But like, the concept is really cool, which is that like you're investigating a crime and you're trying to figure out what happened, or not a crime, but like a situation. But it never is like that satisfying either, because it, you know, you feel like you're being fed the answers, or because like the genre isn't, the world isn't that interesting. Like I don't really want to play a cop. But if you tell me that I am in a game about discovering and confronting a vampire conspiracy, I'm in. And the way
I guess you should kind of walk back to from Gumshoe to what is Knights Black Agents, which is Jason Bourne versus vampires.
Yeah, I mean, exactly right. You're a super spy. You choose a background, which is basically like, you know, what were you doing before you became a super spy? Like, what is your skill set? And that background determines your skill set and like where you're coming at this from. And the cool thing about Knights Black Agents is that you choose like kind of it, the rule book suggests like the genre of vampire spy thriller you're playing. And so there's Dust, which is the gritty techno thriller. There's Mirrors, which has a lot of paranoid bluffing, double crosses and manipulation. There's Burn, which is pushing the characters to their mental and emotional limits, and Stakes, which is monster hunting action adventure. So my idea for the video game is that it's essentially like, it's like a point and click, you know, you're seeing like illustrations of being in a, like a hideout and, in an office and in all these different places. You're, you know, it's, Shane, I don't know how to describe it, but basically like you're not like controlling a character that's moving through the world, but you're clicking through various screens.
Yep.
But you get to choose when the game starts, it would ask you, do you want to do Dust, Mirrors, Burn, or Stakes? And then character wise, you know, there is a ton of different background options you can choose from. But I think like for the video game, there would just be like, you could choose between like wet worker, hacker, and like analyst or something. And the background you choose would influence, the options that are available to you. So the cool thing about Gumshoe is that like, if you have a really high score in athletics, it doesn't matter if it's because you're naturally gifted as an athlete or because you like underwent military training. So like that is something that like, again, you would lose in the game. But what's cool about it is that like whichever background you choose comes with a certain kinds of skills that open up different kinds of paths for you to solve the mystery. And so that is like what the game would capture.
It sounds very ambitious,
like, yeah,
especially for yeah, like a visual novel-esque kind of game where you've got to illustrate all these paths in order to make them equally satisfying. So
yeah, that's the thing. So like one of the things I wrote in my note is that in my notes is that like everything you like basically the game, it would really be like four games in one, because you would have to create, like you said, like a satisfying path no matter what character you choose. So yeah, this is one of those games that like can't actually be created in the real world with anyone's real money. But and that's why it's an honorable mention.
Okay.
But you know, I think visual novel type games are really good for capturing like an ambiance, like the Telltale games. Like this would be a good, like Telltale's Knights Black Agents, I think would be great.
Yeah, no, I think that makes sense, especially for the Burn. Like they do a really good job if you take that kind of like grittier comic book art style, and like you can really like with good music, I think you can really like lay in the kind of psychological element that makes Burn mode kind of challenging. The sort of like, what are you sacrificing of yourself in order to hunt this monster, right? Like, you know, not that it's vampires, so it's never really that you're the bigger monster than the vampire. That's absurd, but like, it's the lengths that you will go to, right? The sacrifices that you'll make to do the right thing, which tends to be personal and family and professional, right?
Totally.
Like kind of changing who you are as a person in order to succeed at this thing that is that important to you.
Totally. I think, you know, this is the kind of thing where you sit down to create the game as I've described it. And then after like 2 weeks of ideation, you're like, let's just make this a fucking straight up visual novel, you know, like it's too complicated. And that's what, where I'm landing at the end of my pitch. I'm just like, let's just give this to Telltale RIP and like have them create a really cool atmospheric vampire spy thriller. Why mess with it beyond that, honestly?
All right. Well, if we're handing things off to Telltale, we should probably end the segment.
It is a really good time to just really casually transition to our next segment, which is something that we are excited about right now. I cannot talk enough, Shane, about the docuseries Scientology and the Aftermath, which I believe is no longer on, but there are a few seasons of it. And it's Leah Remini talking about basically telling the stories of people who have been in Scientology and gotten out of it. It's super fascinating. I'm also listening. She has a podcast now called Scientology, The Aftermath, I think. Mm-hmm. I'm like incredibly here for like stories about cults and people leaving them and getting to learn the like nitty gritty of like how Scientology works is just fucking fascinating. And Leah Remini, like, look, I'm here to tell you that she seems rad. Like, she's, her whole thing is like, I was in Scientology. I caused a lot of like harm by being in Scientology and advocating for it. And one of the ways I want to try to make up for the harm I've done is to expose them and like spare other people harm and like help other people. And she just has a really winning personality. And I'm not here to put celebrities on pedestals because who knows what they're really like, but you know, she's just really winning and she's interesting to listen to. It's really fascinating to learn about the inner workings of Scientology. I have to say that when you learn more about L. Ron Hubbard, the word Scientology is so good. It's like, of course he created a cult. He thought of the word Scientology.
Oh, like he created it like on a dare, right? He was like, I can make a cult. Cults are easy to make. Watch.
Watch me go.
Yeah.
It's amazing. The internal logic of Scientology. It is actually the most brilliant like pyramid scheme that you've ever heard of. So highly recommend that. It's on Hulu and it's on iTunes and stuff like that. And then I just want to say before I throw it to you, Shane, is that I want to plug a podcast that I was just a guest on and I couldn't think of another place to plug it than here. So I was a guest on Cult Classic Callback, which is a really rad podcast hosted by two very lovely people who are married to each other. And maybe they're just in a loving long-term relationship. I hope they're married because I just said they were, but no judgment if you're not, that's fine. And basically what they do is they ask a guest to, their thing is like, they haven't seen a lot of movies. So they ask a guest to like choose a movie and then you go on and talk about it. So we talked about the movie, but I'm a Cheerleader. And it was really fun. And that episode drops the same day this drops, which is August 4th. So please listen to it. Sorry for rejecting the premise of the segment. Shane, what are you really excited about right now?
I am excited. This weekend is the finale of Naked and Afraid XL, I think season 5. So as you know, I am a connoisseur of highbrow and uplifting reality television.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So I don't really get into housewives, but I do get into people who are primitive survivalists thrown into odd situations in uninhabitable environments. This time, this season, they have been in South Africa. This was a twist on an old classic. They have to spend 40 days in Africa surviving. They are given like nothing more than a knife, a cast iron pot to boil water in, and they have like a bag and then like one item they choose from home. So usually it's like somebody brings like a bow and arrow, somebody brings like fishing line, you know, like a utility item. And then they are forced to survive in like, you know, in this season, it's like 120 degree plus noon heat in South Africa. Also they're being hunted by crocodiles and hyenas and stuff. Like it's fucking insane. And they can exile each other from their like groups now, which is just too fantastic. But so obviously not everybody makes it. People tap out. The producers like, you know, have medical concerns and things like that. So people have to leave. But it's an interesting show. The survival element is kind of secondary to some of the personal drama. The personal drama is, you know, sometimes a little like overkeyed, but in the way that all reality TV is scripted, it is great. And you know, it's interesting. Like, I hate that it's called Naked and Afraid, because like that was obviously like the writer or the like producer's pitch to get this thing greenlit like 8 years ago when it started. Like, mm-hmm. hey, we're going to take two people and throw them out in the wilderness naked and see what happens. It's a guy and a girl, but it'll be crazy. Right. And like that was clearly a marketing campaign that had a reality TV show made for it. But this Excel, mm-hmm. like these challenges that are 40 days, like they're very interesting. Like the paths that people take. There's one guy on there named Bulant, who is like this Turkish former military guy who is just soloing the whole adventure himself because he doesn't like people. And it's
so good.
Amazing. Like this guy is just like he walks into where some other guy is camped who's lost all of his partners. And he's like, the guy wants to partner up. And he's like, I don't think so. Hey, can I borrow your bow? And the guy's like, no, you just like walked in with a bunch of food and wouldn't share. And he's like, okay. And then he like goes to the camera and he's like, I'll get the bow when he taps out in a few days. And sure enough, it happens.
It's amazing. Such incredible, like, Don Draper as a survivalist energy.
Exactly that. Yeah. He's like, you can't try to make Africa your bitch. He's like, it will kill you. So you just got to take what it gives you. Like, I will take this bow.
Oh, so good. So you mentioned this casually to me and we were playing Minecraft Dungeons and there was like a record scratch and I was like, I need to understand everything about this TV show. It sounds fucking amazing. I cannot believe that like the people who make it are able to like pay for the insurance required, because it just, yeah. When you tell me what it, I'm just like, how are people not just like dropping dead left and right? Especially when you think about like, do they not have sunblock?
Well, a lot of times what they do is they use mud or they use ash from like their fire pit, right? So yeah, that's okay, absolutely okay. A thing that people have to deal with. Like sun poisoning is totally a thing. But yeah, no.
Damn.
They also can't brush their teeth, right? So think about that for 40 days. So you use charcoal to prevent you from like losing teeth. Also, they're starving for a lot of this, you know? It's not like they're well fed, so... It's really interesting.
Yeah, I want to watch it, but I actually prefer just like hearing, it's like, this is a podcast I listen to, which is like Shane talking about Naked and Afraid, which I feel like is better than watching. But I also didn't realize that there was such a thing as like, is it called primitive survivalism?
Yeah.
Is that what it is? Where it's like, yeah, okay, so people's like hobby is like basically figuring out like and testing themselves, like how they would survive in these conditions, right?
Yeah. And a lot of times it's people who are like outdoorsmen anyway, mm-hmm. or outdoors people, right? Or they work in environments that are like remote, right? So like park rangers and things like that, right? Where you're naturally like more exposed to be in a position where you might have to like survive. A lot of like military people, even though like military survival tends to be really like technology based, like there's still a lot of like very primitive survival principles that are taught in military survival. So like that's a natural outflow. I mean, like, you know, like there's a community of hobbyists for everything.
True.
And it seems that like the group of people who are like, who go on Naked and Afraid at this point is a pretty small, relatively close-knit community, because they all know each other. Like they've all seen each other's episodes by the time they start, right? So I think it's a pretty, it's not a huge community obviously, but like, you know, if you're a homesteader in like Alaska, like you're gonna need primitive survival skills, right? Like if you don't make it back to your cabin one night, like you need to know how to survive for a night in the, you know, you need to know how to start a fire, you need to know how to build a shelter, you need to know what to do if it snows.
Like, totally, you know. I would definitely die within like 12 hours.
Yeah.
There's no way I would, like, I would, I wouldn't even get to the point where I like starve to death. I would be eaten by an animal, or I would die of like exposure, like instantly.
I would tap out when the water tasted bad. like I can't do this. I'm out.
So same. Amazing. Okay. Well, I hope that you will update us next time about like who won and so on. Cause did they win something?
No, they win bragging rights. It's the saddest.
Yeah.
It's not a competition. It's a co-opetition.
A co-opetition. Okay. I love a good co-opetition. All right. Well, I think that's it for this episode. So please, if you are enjoying us, please rate us and review us on iTunes and anywhere else you listen to podcasts.
And you can also follow us on Twitter at Co-op Mood Pod with no punctuation, or you can follow me at Mundangerous. That's M-U-N Dangerous.
And you can follow me at Sally T. And you can and should email us your ideas for video games based on RPGs at coopmoodpod@gmail.com.
And you can find us and other great gaming podcasts on the OneShot Network at oneshotpodcast.com.
Co-op Mood is produced by Shane and Sally, edited by Lucas. Our music is Pixel Squirrel by Espresso Music. Logo design by Emily Cardamus.